Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas, brought to you by the Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to some of today's most important and most controversial issues. Today's guest is Shelby Steele. Shelby's a renowned author and scholar on race in American society and the consequences of social programs on race relations. He's formerly the Robert and Marian Oster Senior Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institutions. He's written widely and received numerous honors and awards for his work, including the Bradley Prize, the National Humanities Medal, an Emmy Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1990. Perhaps he's best known for his book in 2006, White Guilt: How Blacks and Whites Together Destroyed the Promise of the Civil Rights Era. He has a PhD in English, a master's in sociology, and a bachelor's in political science, that degree from Coe College in Iowa. Most importantly, I admire him as one of the very few people today that has the courage to speak out bluntly and directly on America's most divisive issue, race. He's an independent thinker, has that rare courage to speak the truth on an issue that we desperately need to fix in our country. Shelby and I have a provocative conversation about the meaning and perspective on what is this most damaging and polarizing issue, race relations. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Shelby Steele, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to see you again. You write in, I think, quite a bit of what your career has been devoted to has been this idea that good intentions or not, the practice of the civil rights movement has ultimately been not just a failure, but disastrous, harmful to the Black community. And I'd like to go through that, what your thinking is on that. And of course, we'll talk a little bit more in detail about the theses of your most important of the many important books. But I'd like to go to that theme, because as Milton Friedman, our former colleague, said many things that were very wise as well. And one of his theses were, judge a program by its results, not its intention.
Yes. Yeah, boy, that's a hard framework of analysis for civil rights.
Right.
Boy. Yeah. Again, I remember my father, we always had a garden. We couldn't conveniently go to a supermarket. They didn't have them in the Black community. Still don't, for that matter, many. And his idea was that these programs that the civil rights movement was fighting for would make you a slave all over again. And he hated them. And he would argue with people and tell them he couldn't respect that this was a humiliation to Black America, not a gift, not something that would make them
self-sufficient. Yeah.
He didn't use the language I'm using now, but it was similar, which is to say that framework deprived you of agency over your own life. In a healthy society, you are the agent of, and you live in freedom, and you find ways. If this doesn't work, then you try. You are responsible for making this a decision for something that will work. In other words, is the world should be a free market and more than just economic ways. And what happened then is that President Johnson was the sort of main architect of the Great Society and the War on Poverty and so forth, where the government said, we will fix you up. We ruined you. We sat upon you for three centuries. We owe you something. We know it. And here's, depending on how you calculate the money, in the trillions of dollars over the 70 years since the Civil Rights Act was passed in 64. Well, there you are. You have received this acknowledgement of what was done to you, but it did the worst possible thing it could do. It taught you to do everything but live in freedom, but make decisions that you were responsible for. You dealt with an accountability that you were going to be responsible for, and you saw white people all around you pick up and fill up their wagon trains and go west. They fought Indians, they fought nature. They were in possession of their own lives. But blacks, no, we're gonna put you in an apartment building in an urban environment, and we're gonna give you a certain amount of money for food and a certain, treating you like an inhuman sort of again victim,
incapable. It's a culture of victimhood, I think, is what many, including you, have used the phrase. And that's destructive. And also, as you wrote back in 2001, you said that the civil rights movement and programs were, quote, shaped more by the stigmatization of whites than by any other factor, including the actual needs of blacks, unquote. So, it's that they were harmful to Black American success, but they weren't even geared in reality, in your thinking, toward Black American success. They were more geared toward this idea of white guilt, of relieving white guilt. And this is, of course, your most famous, I think, and most important concept that you talked about in 2006 in your book, White Guilt, which is that when you examine the rationale for all these programs, much of it, in your opinion, if am I saying it correctly, was really due to relieving guilt rather than actually solving problems.
Well said. That is it. That's the point. You think about it, there's a certain obvious logic to it. As blacks were sitting there, the country that's oppressed us now has set us free and gives us apartment buildings and jobs and all sorts of things. We're receiving all this, but again, our life is not in our own hands. In order to get an apartment on the south side of Chicago and the welfare, under the welfare terms of those days and now, the woman can have the apartment, and the minute she has a man come in, she loses it. So the federal government of the United States is carving into the black family and breaking it up, destroying it. And they did. And, when I was a kid, black people got married. Now there are no bridal shops in black neighborhoods because nobody's getting married. Women live on welfare. They have children as teenagers. The family, which is the unit that one needs in order to handle the challenges of freedom. You have to have a family. There's nothing to substitute for a father in the home. The government can't do that. Only you can do that. But if you can't have a family, then slowly but surely, disillusionment creeps into the picture, and you have the situation we have today, which is this great city of Chicago that I grew up in and loved, is a hellhole. No one would volunteer to live, who comes out of a tradition of freedom and accepting the challenges of freedom. No one would want to would want to bypass that.
I'm wondering why is that logic that you said just now missing from the conversation to a great extent about the so-called inequality issue? And we could talk about this concept of equity versus equality, but why is it that we don't hear a lot of people talking about that? Is it the need for family, the harms of the civil rights programs? Instead, it seems to be that the dominant narrative is still more is needed. There's two aspects. One is white leadership, as you say and have said many times, whites have no moral authority on the issue. And you point out that President Reagan, being so popular, he's still not a believer, his administration, in these racial preferences, et cetera, they never addressed it. They never spoke out. He never really did, because whites have no moral authority on these issues. And that's one side of it. But the other side is the black leadership, if I can separate people like that. Because we still, you know, I happen to work out in the gym in Palo Alto, and I watch on TV, all the TVs are, of course, set to MSNBC and CNN in Palo Alto, in the gym. And you see the constant racial so-called, you know, talking heads, or if you want to use the word experts, and they really are not talking about these traditional American values being a core part of the solution. Instead, it's more of the same. Why? Where is everybody? Where are the Shelby Steels of today?
Canceled. If they really truly are interested in freedom, you know, we could be here for a month talking about this, but the first point you made comes under the rubric of what I call white guilt, that is a situation where in 64, 65, War on Poverty, all these government programs and so forth come on board. There's money everywhere where there wasn't it before and so forth. And Johnson is going for preferential treatment of one kind or another to fix the race problem and so forth. What people neglected was the fact that white Americans had to live with a real concrete circumstance in which they felt historic guilt over the history. How could you not? You're sitting in a society, in the wealthiest society in history, in the world, and your memory, your history is part of that history was the persecution of millions of people, of human beings, for no reason other than the color of their skin. And then finally, one day, those people get freedom. How do you handle that? Most of the programs that the government then created to deal with that problem would really and truly designed to get after that
shame.
After the shame, the sense of the charge that your success, your wealth is a measure not of your character, but of your corruption. And white America has flailed against that accusation. One of the things it means to be white in America is to be on the defensive regarding poverty and race and all these things. If the subject comes up, people run the other way. There's no winning it for whites, because whites now have historically acknowledged this. And this is a burden that white America carries.
Right.
And this is what's behind all of the civil rights programs and the DEI and affirmative action and on and on. All those programs are designed much more to deal with this difficulty in white life than the difficulties in black life. And so here in the black community, we're what's up and what's down? Maybe I should build a life around begging from white people. Maybe I should I should raise my children in a sense, but it communicates they live in a world in which their inferiority is rewarded, and
right.
their talent is ignored.
I mean, you've said whites do a lot of things because not because they believe them, but because it buys them innocence from
yes.
all the evils of Western civilization. Which,
right.
of course, you know, as we know from working with economists all our lives, both of us, but not being economists, we do understand that incentives are critical in terms of what happens. And this is the incentive of white America, is to relieve themselves of guilt rather
yes.
than actually think through the results of what is done. And I think that's I don't hear other people say that, and it seems like it's one of the things that are obvious and remain unable to be said.
Yes, I that's exactly right. I think that they are unable to say it. It is, you know, you wanna have a sort of jingoistic happiness regarding your national identity. And whites, after 1964, which was when the Civil Rights Bill was passed, whites since then have had a real struggle in that area. And it's a tragedy because the people they wanted to help, blacks and other minorities, are still languishing here. Look at the report card of black performance in public schools. I mean, we're at the bottom of every single important test of development. And again, we haven't found a way yet to make, and I try to do this in my work, at least I try, that we should be free to and encouraged and incentivized to take responsibility for ourselves.
Right.
Innocence, the pursuit of white innocence, forces us to take responsibility, to not take responsibility for ourselves, to think and believe that what really will get us ahead in life is not our command of our own life, but our dependency on the benevolent goodwill of white people.
You said that when Trump was first elected back in 2017, you wrote a piece, and you said, your greatest hope for the Trump administration was to find a way to get this, what you called this concept, this way of life called individual responsibility, to take hold. That was back in 2017. Where are we now with that concept? Has anything changed?
Well, certainly not much. If anything, in the election of Mr. Trump has jiggled things a bit. There now is at least a kind of subcategory of called the Black conservative. Well, what is the Black conservative? Is he conservative? I don't know. I'm called that all the time. What is that? It's just simply a Black person who realizes that he's not going to get anywhere unless he takes responsibility for his own life, for getting there, and carries a certain disdain for not doing that.
Mm-hmm. This
I'm not
used
impressed
to be in
that you got a bigger government contract than I got.
In Chicago, when we were kids, this was called the Democrat Party, the working class, with the original Mayor Daley.
Right.
It has nothing to do with conservative. It had to do with simply work hard and to get ahead.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Whites don't excuse themselves from hard work and development and rigorous development. They excuse Blacks. They say we'll lower the test score minimums in terms of college admissions. We'll just make it easier, and so what you get then is a group of people who say, well, yes, Blacks say, well, yeah, that's right, you do owe us, because goodness knows you did all those things that you made us suffer. You sat there and watched it for three centuries, so you owe us dependency. We like you if you encourage our dependency. We respect you. If you don't grant us as whites our innocence, we don't respect you. And we have contempt for you, and we will push you to the sideline. We're looking for a mask we can wear. Well, I don't think you love me much if you want me to be, you think success for me is dependency. I don't think you care.
But it seems that we're in an era, instead of going, this is just my own opinion, but it seems like instead of going toward more accountability, more individual effort to get ahead on the basis of work and seeking opportunity, we have, I think, a narrative that is pushing more and more for so-called reparations. And I'm living in California, and okay, I don't know, I'm not a good predictor, but my prediction is that California will lead the way on so-called reparations. What's your reaction to this discussion of a need for financial reparations now?
I've heard figures that we've spent over $3 or $4 trillion on social programs since 1964. We are vastly farther behind whites in every area, every important area of American life, after 30, 40 years of that kind of reparations and so forth. And so if you give me reparations now, then, you know, I'm gonna put that money, I'm gonna do exactly the same thing that we did the first time around. I'm gonna say, you owe it to me and I want more. And you're shortchanging me on the reparations. That's racism. And you're a racist if you aren't just giving me one thing after another. Well, we as Blacks are going to have a bill to pay if we keep that up. White people today did not do anything. Maybe they would have if they'd had a chance, but they just aren't in that position. And the problem is, again, that you psychologically imbue a fate in that is where other people again control your life, your happiness, everything, and you just sort of shuffle around the edges, pretending that you're living a normal, you are in charge of your life when in fact you're not, and you're falling farther behind again. And what you want to do is lower the standards so that merit is racist, as you may not know, but it is racist. And so merit too has to be, where blacks are concerned, reduced. So we don't get good. Wherever there's no affirmative action, there's no dependency, we thrive. People look at basketball and sports and so forth. Well,
nothing more merit-based than professional sports, I would
say.
That's
right. And the people, the blacks I know who play sports, do not believe in dependency. If you come out on the playground in high school and you want to play basketball and you don't help me get a basket and you can't play, we talk about your mama, we talk about everything. We want you to be, show us something that is advanced, that is new, that is exciting, that where your esteem is on the line, where your faith in yourself counts. We're in a society now that takes all that away from us. It's not. It's me, a bleeding heart white, who is responsible for you getting into UCLA. Well, oh, man, who wants to go to UCLA under those circumstances? I would rather go to UCLA with a standard of merit that is higher than everybody else's. So when I see that black student on campus, I say, "Whoa." I know that this is a person who is truly interested in developing themselves. Well, we have these are going to be our challenges, it seems to me, in the future, is coming into this, because we're not, it's bigger than America. It's modernity itself.
Yes,
to join modernity, we have to master these skills. We have to develop. We have to put a focus on skill development, on academic development, on economic development. Develop, and become a part of this movement of human history that we think of as modernity. People who do that thrive. You see that everywhere in the world.
And we do have a glimmer of positive, I would say, and I think you've noted this in your recent interview with the Wall Street Journal that was published, and that is the Donald Trump election, the second Donald Trump term, where there was what one could say is a glimmer of a shift. And that is, as you pointed out, that maybe people are starting to think that race is not a reason to have blind loyalty to who you elect as president of the United States. What do you think the election showed us? With the shift of young blacks and other minorities toward a little bit breaking toward Donald Trump.
Well, I think that we're at a place where, and Trump sort of represents this, where we can't help it. History itself is sort of moving us along, It's saying to blacks and whites a little differently, but it's saying that there's nowhere else for you to go. There's you can get reparations and as much as you want, but you've already gotten trillions of dollars. of reparations. We can give you another couple trillion and you'll still be far behind. You'll still be at the very bottom. You'll be at the bottom until you take charge of your own life, until you stop looking at white people as people to shake down with guilt. That's history put us in a position where we did that, where it was inevitable to do that. I remember I grew up, I was a part of that, Black Panthers and all that sort of thing. But it gets us nowhere. I'm not sure I answered the question there, but
no, I think you've reflected on this. There's a slow, what you called a slowly emerging reality that Blacks actually are in charge of their own fate. And I think this is something that, that you've talked about as, one of the things that you've inferred from the election of Donald Trump. And also what you said was the recognition that someone that is running that happens to have the same skin color, and here I'm talking about Kamala Harris, as the Black community, you called that almost an insult, in that you had someone who did not portray competence, articulate knowledge, deep knowledge of issues, but you were sort of shamed into voting for her simply based on race or ethnicity. And, you've said there's some glimmer of hope here that people are realizing that that isn't the basis for what should be done by the Black community.
Yes, I think that idea now is, it has a, people are, and I attribute this to Trump. Many Blacks now, I think, have come to the place where they're at least open. I mean, throughout much of my lifetime, if you were Black and you were against reparations, that was about as horrible a group betrayal as was possible. It took me a long time to really think that through and understand the position it keeps us in is one of children, where we're just constantly dealing with a society in which we're seen and treated as people who are unable to live and meet the terms of freedom, like we expect of other people, and so there is now Black shame. There's beginning to be why, when I ride through the South Side now, I used to drive a bus up and down the South Side of Chicago. Why now is that not so much the case? And I think some of it is that this is changing, is that we understand that there's something a little corrupt, something that compromises our character in asking the society to lower standards for us. And that's a quietly held point of view, but my sense is, it's developing, it's expanding. Nothing left for us to do, nowhere else for us to go.
Mm-hmm. There's a reality here that you're forced to.
Self-determination, yeah.
I'm curious about your reception of your views, and I've seen a little bit of it at Stanford, at Hoover, but I'm curious, I'd like to hear you talk about how your views, your work, your thesis, being such a contrarian and what I call a truth teller on probably the most divisive issue in the country of all the divisive issues. How were you received by academia and separately by the media?
With great, great trepidation. They talk about canceling this year. I've been canceled for 40 years at this point. And they just, any message but this one. Because this one shames everybody. It seems to shame anybody. My feeling is it sets us all free. It's exactly what we need. We need to be a little ashamed right now. We can't have the Al Sharptons of the world leading us into some sort of new level of society. Joe Smith down at the corner, who runs a gas station and a mechanics shop there, and is trying to open up a second one after 20 years of work. That's the person who our future depends on. No one cares. He's in competition. No one cares, what his race is. They care about how much he charges for a gallon of gas. The charm, I think, of President Trump is that's him. How much does a gallon of gas cost? How much do bananas cost? And there's no sort of ideological framework in play. There is an acceptance of simple things, of meeting human needs. Well, we as blacks can do that. There are millions of blacks who've been doing that for all the way back to slavery.
Absolutely.
Who have been successful and have raised families and done all these things. It makes me, my heart sing when I see a young black come on a university campus and not demand black this and black that. But who says, let me take a good substantial class here in which I can develop and understand the way the modern world works,
mm-hmm.
and find my place in it.
I wonder, having been at Hoover myself, and you've been there for many, many years, and they had a recent event honoring Tom Sowell, and it makes me ask the question, why is someone such a independent thinker like you? I put you in the same mix as Clarence Thomas and Tom Sowell, in the willingness to say what is completely unacceptable to people everywhere, not just black, not just white, everyone. I think the overwhelming majority of people would find and do find what you and Clarence Thomas and Tom Sowell say antithetical to what they want to believe, even though it's common sense and to me, what I would say is the truth. What distinguishes, what gives you that independence? I just sort of, I've been asked myself, and I'm not putting myself on your level, but I've been asked, why was I willing to speak the truth about COVID or whatever under an attack by the media, by the politicized world we live in? And it's because, truth matters. But I still don't know why people like you, Clarence Thomas, Tom Sowell, are so different. What is the background that gives you that?
It's a good question, a complicated one. But by the way, I do admire the way you did handle the COVID thing.
I wasn't fishing for a compliment, but thank you.
No, but nevertheless, it's one is deserved. I think in human affairs and human situations, there are always people like you and to a degree like myself, Tom Sowell certainly. I see sort of the granddaddy of all of this. What a willful fellow he is, and how irrelevant his race is. He came from a family in the South and moved up north and found his way one way or another, where he got this idea. I don't know, but I know his work well, and wow, he is an inspiration. But I think there is, and again, human affairs, there simply is, no matter if you take 100 people and you put them in a little village and they and leave them alone, some are going to rise to the top and some are going to sink to the bottom, and all points in between. We produce in our society what we need, and we often don't like what we need and don't like to deal with it, but we need it anyway, and it has to be ultimately integrated. The world now is screaming at blacks. We've had enough. You made your point. You're free. Knock, knock. You're free. We're not going to lower the standards at every academic institution in America so that we can continue to feel guilty and you can continue to feel dependent. It's time for you to become independent. And it's time for us as white Americans to begin to acknowledge what happened in the past and move into the future. Simply move away from that. There's no way to erase that from history. It is history. We're at a point where the white guilt, the sense that, oh, we're not the glorious America that we say we are. We're really mean and evil and blah, blah. That's not, that helps no one at this point. We've got to, with all due apology and regret for that, whites have to begin to believe in their own innocence, they know racism now is one of the, if not the top of the list of evils, at work in society. It's just ungodly. It's horrible. There's no compromise with racism. Racism is absolutely always, without the faintest exception, poison. It's poison. Anytime you touch it, anytime you get near it, it's poison. You will join evil if you deal with it, if you practice it in any way. We as Americans have paid to learn that lesson. I expect every day of my life as an American to have that honored, to live in a society that grants me that freedom, asks me, and holds me accountable to it, so that when I get an A in a class, it's not because I'm not a pity case. It's because I got an A in a class. That's it. No more, no less. And that's that it seems to me, is where whites need to make their focus, dependency is the worst possible thing. We know that now.
Right. I think you're pointing out something which is sort of a fascinating concept, because I feel like the biggest void in America today is a lack of courage. And in this sense, I'm going to tie it into what you're saying, which is that the lack of courage here is by whites, by white America, for having the courage to say, we don't need to keep relieving or trying to relieve guilt. Let's admit these programs have been destructive and move forward with the idea of equal opportunity and personal accountability, rather than these so-called pseudo civil rights programs that ended up having harmful impact. And that's a lack of courage, in my view, on the part not just of politicians, but of white America in general. They feel better. I'm painting with a broad brush, of course, but it seems like white America still feels better about trying to relieve their own guilt rather than do the right things.
Well, that's absolutely right. That is the problem. And whites like that hate me. I run into most of the resistance I get now is from whites who want that black suffering. Black suffering is like it's like a currency of power. If I encounter black suffering, then here's victimization. And the victimization, again, is that these people are somehow in line with the old evil segregation and so forth, that they're racist. And so that becomes then, I approach it an institution in American life, and I take that currency of power and I put it on the table and say, you also get another incentive for you to take me is that you can use me to get money from the system, to get whites hungry for innocence. And in other words, we can play this whole game and you get something and I get something. And that's the symbiosis that we now have, that races now have in America, one living off the other, living off the shame of the other. And blacks have now a lot to be ashamed of. That's the subtext behind what's happening in Chicago today, with the murder rates, 10, 20 people every weekend being shot and killed and so forth. They're then want to negotiate around this. This is what that victimization of three centuries did. It left us Chicago. And you're guilty, and you owe me this, and you owe me that.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to shift gears to talk a little bit about your foundation, the Shelby Steele Foundation, which I was reading a little bit about. And, it provides scholarships to college-bound teens and what you called original thinkers who are striving for equality of opportunity. And I want to read two quotes that you have said on that website. One is, opportunity follows struggle. It follows effort. It follows hard work. It doesn't come before that. And the second one is, the promised land guarantees nothing. It is only an opportunity, not a deliverance. Any kind of concluding thoughts you have about that, and maybe how successful that kind of foundation effort has been?
Well, I believe in evolution. I mean, in social evolution as well as biological. I think we are evolving to that. Again, the meeting you referred to a little while ago that Hoover had a couple of weeks ago. They're sort of an advanced team. And they're a new generation coming forward. And I think they understand this. Whether they say it in exactly the same words or not, I don't know. But there's beginning to be an understanding of this. And the thing, if I'm going to be, the thing that makes me happiest in life is to see my people overcome those three centuries. Overcoming has got to be the goal here. Overcoming is victory. It's the promised land. It's all those things. That's what I long to see when I see flashes of that, I met a girl who works what's the name of the stationery store? Staples.
Okay.
A young black girl, and she came up to me and we talked for a while she said that she said sometimes she had read something I'd written, And she said, sometimes I just look at that and I can keep going. I can, because then I know it's on me. It's on me. And I wish I could reproduce her, but I can't.
Right.
But it makes you feel good. It makes Absolutely. You feel really to see you don't have to take care of, treat me like a baby forevermore because of what people did 3 centuries ago. It's never going to go away. It's a part of history. Let's move on. And whites, please, please put money where development can happen. I hope our scholarship program does that. We want people, we want development. We want kids who are ready to be responsible and move ahead.
Right. There's nothing more liberating, I look at it, than competing and winning. That's the work ethic. And, you know, I come from the same sort of background, although obviously I'm white. But
don't apologize.
I don't apologize for it. In fact, I'm the first generation who went to college. And I think in my family, a family of immigrants, the work ethic is what made America. And people come here specifically for opportunity, for individual and family success.
Yeah.
And somehow we have to hope that is the message, because that's why America is a great country. It's not, people don't come here for entitlements and handouts. And we have to recognize, as you say so often, these programs are failures. They're destructive. And we need courageous leadership to step up and say it. And it's got to be from the black and the white leadership in our society. So I'm hoping we see a little crack of that with this subtle shift of voters toward Trump. It remains to be seen. I'm still very concerned, but I'm hopeful. And I want to thank you really for everything that you have done. You know, I've seen you speak many times at Hoover and read a lot of your work, and it's so important and impactful. I'm hoping that there's another generation of Shelby Steeles to take up that mantle.
I'd go for that. Well, thank you, and thanks for having me. You represent precisely the kind of voice that I long to see at work and in play in this whole situation. You've got it, and it's going to have impact on people. It's going to make people think. Because you have a lot of moral authority as well. You're not afraid to talk about these things. You're not afraid of the truth. Because I know you'll pay a price.
Yes, sir. But you got to keep your eye on the ball, right? I mean, it seems very obvious, but the frustration is, it seems like we don't have a lot of people who see what's so obvious. But we keep going. We don't give up. And I thank you, Shelby, again, for taking the time today. Hope to have you back again.
Well, hope to come back again. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Shelby Steele, check out his many important books and interviews and watch for his upcoming film early in the 2026 year, an update to his book, White Guilt. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube as well as Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.